Let's go, let's go, let's go. Tempo in and out of the huddle.
I want to go odd. 5-51 mirror.
This is Patriots Playbook.
Go stack guts combat. Odd. 51 mirror.
Patriots Playbook. Breaking down last Sunday's game.
They're looking for man coverage in the zone. They didn't have anybody to throw to. Just stay outside on the 7 route.
Next Sunday's game.
Be ready for the greats check, too, okay? Because we'll get the bunch on 3rd and short. Even 51 greats. Even 51 greats.
And the rest of the NFL season.
Yeah, go ahead and hit it in there because the backers are going to fast read over the top.
And some of the fun stuff in between. Now, here's John Rook on Patriots Playbook.
Come on, let's go, let's go.
There is an old adage, I think, and it may not even be old, because I think it's still apropos today. However, there's a phrase that I like to go by that I like to use in times like this. And it goes something like this. Old lucky is better than old nothing.
What is it?
Old lucky is better than old nothing.
Old lucky.
Old lucky is better than old nothing. And I believe that to be the case for the New England Patriots on Monday night. We welcome you inside Patriots Playbook for week two of the regular season as the Pats get ready now for the J-E-T-S, Jets. New York Jets playing on Sunday afternoon at the Meadowlands in East Rutherford, New Jersey. I'm John Rook. Eric Scalavino from Patriots Football Weekly is here in our opening hour. Our second hour of the program will feature Lisa Zimmerman, who covers the Jets, amongst other items, for CBSSports.com. And she will join us to talk a little bit about the specific matchups with the Jets and the Patriots coming up on Sunday. And, of course, it looks like both teams now have linebacking difficulties. The Jets, obviously, due to a suspension. But CBS Sports itself right now is confirming that or saying, or they're reporting, I should say, that they are confirming Jerod Mayo has a grade 3 sprained MCL. And the timetable for his return is uncertain. However, their folks tell them that the likely missed time for a grade 3 sprain, which represents a complete tear of the MCL as opposed to a grade 1 and grade 2, which are incomplete tears, the timetable for a return for a grade 3 is 6 to 8 weeks.
Well, that's a lot better news than what we were fearing when we saw the play, which was out for until next year.
Yeah, a long time, right.
So, I mean, you'll have to look at the silver lining in this case, I think, and the fact that it sounds like he's going to play again this year, probably sometime after the bye week when we get back from
London.
Exactly
the point.
So,
exactly the point. Looks like he could be back for half number two of the season, you know, with if everything continues to go well with his rehab and such. But, yeah, it would be after London and be right at the midway point of the season.
You know, John, we talked, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, the first show previewing, I think we said – you were asking me what I thought would be best case scenario heading into the bye week, and I said if you were 5-2, I think you should be happy.
I think
I'm still taking that. If we're five and two, I'll still be happy.
I think I'm coming to your side of the story now. I think 5-2 at the bye week would probably be pretty good when you consider number one, losing Mayo at least up and through that time is what it looks like now.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the offense is sputtering.
Well,
number three, they got it together in the second half, but the problem is that Tom Brady was not Brady-like before the fourth quarter.
Right, and I think that is an aberration and not a trend.
We hope. I also did not see much in the way of the running game as well that would give me any thinking that they're going to take a lot of pressure off of Tom. I also want to see them be able to go to Joey Galloway a little bit more than two times I think they did all night on Monday night. So, I mean, there's a lot of other things we have to see unfold.
Sure.
I was a little disappointed in the way that the offense sputtered, and maybe it's because I, my own self, put higher expectations than anybody probably should have on the offense. That's number one. Number two, defensively, I mean, as the game was progressing, Eric, I don't know what your thoughts were, but I get the impression from listening to fans, from reading from fans, from looking at some of the blog sites and looking at some of the fan websites as well, that the initial impression was that the defense was just not good. It was, in fact, even horrible, that it was loose, that they weren't playing tight, that they were giving up big chunks, that they weren't getting the other team off the field. And I think that the main impression here is that one drive, the reason that we're left with that main impression is that one drive they had in the third quarter, the penalty on Wilfork extended?
Well, that drive ended with a punt.
Okay.
Which might have been the Adalys Thomas one.
Thank you. It was the one on Adalys Thomas that they ended up and put it in the end zone, made it 24-13. That was the one. So it was early fourth.
Mm-hmm.
I think because that happened, that there was an overall lasting impression that, well, this defense still can't stop anybody when they need to. Yet, when you look at it statistically, the game wasn't as bad as at least I initially feared it was. Number one, you give up under 300 yards of total offense. Number two, you still win the time of possession battle, if I'm not mistaken. Number three, you held them to 4 for 11 on third down, which is not great, but it's passable.
Yeah, Brian Moorman, the Bills' punter, was out there a lot more times than Chris Hansen for New England, who punted once
right.
in the game.
Right.
So that's a testament to how they played on third down.
Yeah, I think that the nature of the beast is that Buffalo plays, you know, the no huddle. And I think it just seems like teams are out there sometimes a lot longer than they really in actuality are. But, you know, the TOP on the stat sheet and the third down conversion to me, not to mention the total yardage allowed, and plus when you figure that out of the 24 points they scored, really it was only 17.
Right, the Brady pick.
The Brady pick.
By Schoble. Certainly turned the game around because it was 7-7 at that point.
Yes, and then the Thomas penalty, for mm-hmm. slinging Trent Edwards to the ground, kept that drive alive and resulted in a touchdown as well. So I'm thinking, see, you know, there's 14 points you basically handed to him.
Well, yeah, the defense. I mean, no, I think we're all forgetting, fans included, the fact that Terrell Owens played in that game and did nothing.
Right.
So. You know, the game plan going in, everyone thought, oh, it's the return of Brady and T.O. with the Bills. T.O. did zilch against this defense.
Well, I think the team did a good job of game planning.
They certainly did. They took Terrell Owens out of the game.
And take Evans and to take Reed out of the game.
Right. You know,
they took them all out of the
game.
The
one thing they did do well was screen passes with Fred Jackson.
But you have, in other words, to be able to present.
To do one thing, you have to.
To do one thing, you're going to
give up
another.
Something else, right. And I'd much rather try to have Fred Jackson beat you than Terrell Owens.
And here's the thing. My initial impression was, and again, this is just, I'm strictly looking at this from a layman's terms, okay? And because I like to look at things like a fan would. I'm looking at it, you know, I'm watching the ball.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's part of my job. I have to watch the ball anyway. But, you know, strictly from a fan's term, without looking away from the ball, looking at the defensive sets, the one thing I did try to notice was how many times were they in four-man or three-man fronts.
So, it varied throughout the game.
It did vary quite a bit, which told me business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of Mayo being in or out or Seymour being in or out or what have you, it was BAU in terms mm-hmm. of the schematics defensively. Now, the game plan was clearly we're not letting their wide receivers beat us. That we're going to give them the short stuff, we're going to give them the intermediate stuff, we're going to give them the screens out of the backfield, and whomever is at running back, we don't think will ultimately beat us. Now, obviously, that ultimately proved true, although it was really close, because the Patriots had a couple of self-inflicted wounds
sure.
on the penalties
sure.
and certainly on the pick six
sure.
that Brady threw.
Mm-hmm.
But my initial impression was Fred Jackson. I'm like, oh, my God, if Marshawn Lynch is in there, what would be going on here? And obviously, Lynch isn't there because he's still serving a suspension. But I'm thinking, you know, they got to find a way at halftime to make an adjustment and not let Lynch gash you like he did.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little surprised at his overall numbers. I thought he was going to be close to 100 yards rushing for the night.
Yeah,
he was nowhere near it.
He wasn't.
Part of that was probably because he got a lot of his yards, particularly early in the second half, on the screen passes
yep.
that were particularly effective.
Yep.
So while the Patriots were bunched up at the line of scrimmage and ready for him to run the ball, they weren't as much ready for him to catch the ball out of the backfield.
Mm-hmm.
But they were still pressing on the corners. They were still, from what I could tell, and you probably can even speak this a little bit better, they were just concerned with the speed and the athleticism of the Bills' wide receivers beating them for big plays, and they did not want that to happen. So when you take it from the quote-unquote game plan point of view,
it was successful.
Yeah,
I'd have
to say it was a little rough getting there. My initial impression was I didn't really like it, but now that I've had a chance to reflect on it, I understand what they were doing.
I was more concerned before the last 5 minutes of the game, I was more concerned about the offense than the defense in that game. The offense.
More concerned about the offense?
I was more concerned that the offense wasn't getting it together at that point.
Really?
Yeah, they only had scored 13 points.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You mean up?
I was more concerned about New England's offense than New England's defense.
Yeah, you mean up until that point in the fourth quarter?
Up until that point.
Yeah,
in the
I thought
game.
You were talking about going into the game.
No. Going into the fourth quarter.
Fourth quarter.
At that point,
absolutely.
I was saying, boy, the offense hasn't done anything.
Absolutely. In fact,
and the defense actually did enough, I thought, to keep them in the game.
I actually heard, and the fans down right in front of me, around the 40-yard line.
The ones that throw the snowballs.
Yeah, the ones that throw the snowballs. I actually heard a Brady sucks.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, I heard it. I absolutely heard it. And I'm like, oh,
are
man.
Are you kidding
me? Yeah.
Were they around for the end of the game, or did they leave early?
Actually, to their credit, most of them.
So ridiculous.
Most of them stayed there.
It is, Bill. I agree with Bill. That's so ridiculous.
That was ridiculous. But I think it was more of a, well, Brady sucks tonight up until the last 5.5 minutes of the game.
You mentioned the two penalties on Wilfork and AD, respectively, the unsportsmanlike roughing the passer. My initial reaction, and I think my colleagues in PFW agreed as we were sitting there watching the game, the AD one we were flabbergasted by. I mean, our interpretation of the rule, as it was explained to us by Terry McCauley, the official, and his crew that came here during the summer, was, and let's remember, this was called the Tom Brady rule for a reason.
Correct.
Bernard Pollard hit Tom Brady while Bernard Pollard was on the ground lunging for Brady's knee.
He was already on the ground, and he was reaching up trying to grab at anything that moved.
Vince Wilfork was standing up and delivered a textbook wrap-up tackle at the midsection, threw his shoulder pads right into Edwards's midsection, and maybe, a little bit low on the legs, but it was a perfectly legitimate tackle. What else is a guy supposed to do to tackle a quarterback? I was irate at the call. I thought it was a ridiculous interpretation by the officials to throw the flag on that.
It was. That was a bad call.
Other side of the coin, I thought when I first saw it, even before the flag came out, I thought, oh, AD's going to get flagged for that because it looked unnecessary.
You're talking about Thomas, right?
Adalis Thomas. Right. He had Edwards, flipped him around. It was obvious. I think I even heard a whistle that the play was being blown dead because it was obvious Edwards wasn't getting out of that grasp. And Thomas picked him up off the ground and slammed him to the ground.
And
that's unnecessary.
Right. And you can't do the rule is specific. And as I've researched this since the game a couple of nights ago, fact is that the rule book specifically now refers to slinging or throwing the quarterback to the ground, which Thomas did.
Right.
Had he continued with his drive or at least his wrap up, he was just trying to get him down on the ground.
Right.
But what you have to do in this situation now, and the guys have to be cognizant of this.
Just keep the
bear
hold.
Hug on him and keep driving him forward until they blow the whistle, whether you get him on the ground or not.
Right.
But the emotion and the adrenaline rushes, you want to get the
sometimes
guy on the ground
thinking
that you know you need to get the player on the ground before the whistle will blow.
Right. Yeah, I'm not that's a good point. I'm not blaming AD saying he did it maliciously.
No, he did not.
I think it's just a matter of you're so wrapped up in the moment.
And he wasn't cognizant of the rule.
Yeah. Or it's just one of those heat of the moment things. Whatever it was, I thought it was deserving of a flag. I didn't think Wilfork's was at all.
My first, again, impression was that it was a lousy stinking call because what else are you going to do? I mean, you're basically, this is football, damn it. This is football. It's a physical, violent sport, and I'm now officially, by the way, perturbed at this whole protect the quarterback crap. Whether it benefits Tom Brady or not, it's still football, okay?
Yep.
I mean, I realize that there's a lot of money and a lot of salary and a lot of PR and everything wrapped up in the marquee players in this league, but, quite frankly, good teams figure out a way to go, to get over this, number one.
Right.
And number two, why are we carrying 2 and 3 quarterbacks on rosters if you're not prepared for them to play at some point?
Right.
Fact is that you have to, and every team should, plan at some point in time during the season on their backup playing.
Right. The problem that you get with over-legislating the game is that you get both players and officials start to overthink it.
Right.
And it becomes, you ruin the game at that point.
Exactly, which is what I'm afraid we're now embarking on, Eric.
Oh, I agree with
you. We're totally upon now the era of, political correctness in the NFL.
Everything is antiseptic.
And yes, it's just, I knew that we would enter this realm when video replay came into play a few years back. I realize that, but I think, maybe modern technology should catch up with the game and the game should acquiesce and we should get into it because we have the capability. We have the ability, I mean, the fact is that that's the way we've always operated as a human species. Well, we have the capability. Well, then let's do it, regardless of whether it's really good for us or not. We've just done it. And so this is what the NFL now is doing. It's only basically following human nature as far as I'm concerned. And I'm just saying, We need to fight off the urge a little bit. I mean, this game was built for the first 50 to 75 years, as we're, now 90 years into the National Football League. This game, aren't we built about 90 years? Yeah, we're at 90.
Isn't this the 90th year? The 75th anniversary was what, 94?
Then we're at 90.
94, so
this
I think
90,
we're,
brother.
Yeah,
I thought so. This is the 90th year of the National Football League. So for the first 50 to 75 of those, I think we got along okay without all of the, you know, technological advances.
Oh, if you watch any NFL films before 1960, those black and white footage games, I mean, guys were doing ridiculous things to one another
on
the field.
Guys were punching each other in the mouth.
Gouging eyes. What we saw from Adalys Thomas picking up and slamming was kind of tame compared to the way they used to do it.
Well, how can anybody forget the picture of Y.A. Tittle on the ground with Chuck
Bednarik
standing over him, you know, basically in a primeval scream.
That's Frank Gifford
standing. It's not Dwight Tittle.
Frank Gifford on the ground. Thank you.
Frank Gifford. But that's one of the all-time enduring memories, for football fans everywhere. That capsulizes the National Football League. Not only that era, I think it capsulizes the NFL. Mm. It does.
Yeah.
You've got one of the last great two-way players, you know, in NFL history, in Bednarik, who completely creamed, you know,
blindsided Frank
Gifford on that play, and he's standing over him, you know, of course, guys would get flagged in 15 yards and probably suspension and fines for that today because we over-legislate, we over-regulate, it's taunting. That's the way the game was played.
It's an emotional game. It's a violent game. It's a contact. So it's not a contact sport, it's a collision sport.
Well, I didn't like the call on Thomas when it was there. I still don't like it, even though, according to the rule book, I can understand it now. The Vince Wilfork one, you're right, was stupid, and the officiating crew should be ashamed of themselves. It was a textbook tackle.
You can't teach anyone to tackle any better than what Vince Wilfork did on that play.
It was just a ridiculous, stupid, lame, call it whatever you want to. It was a bad call.
So ridiculous.
Yeah, it sure was.
It totally was. The one on Thomas, okay, I see why they made it. I don't agree with it, but I see why they made it.
I just saw, sorry to interject there,
I just saw
the replay of Gerard Mayo's injury.
Yeah, it was just on a screen over here. Yeah.
And I didn't realize it was actually, looks like Vince Wilfork's leg
kind of
hit his knee.
Yeah, reeled on him, yeah.
As Wilfork was trying to back up, he was getting blocked by the center, I guess, on that play. I hadn't seen the replay up until just now.
Right.
But, you know, I think you have to be encouraged if you're a Pats fan that it's only 6 to 8 weeks. And I know that seems, when you're in the middle of it, it seems like a lot. And it is going to be a lot of time to be without him in the middle of the defense there. But the alternative out for the year, I'll take the 6 to 8 weeks.
Again, just to recap what we open up the program with, if you're logging in late here, is that CBSSports.com is confirmed. Boston Globe is also reporting, and ESPN is also adding to the report now that Mayo has a grade 3 sprained medial collateral ligament. The timetable for his return is uncertain. However, a grade 3 sprain usually represents a complete tear of the MCL, as opposed to a grade 1 or grade 2 sprains, which are incomplete tears. In other words, not all the way torn. And the timetable for recovery on a grade 3 normally is 6 to 8 weeks.
Yep.
So those that would be wondering about Gerard Mayo now,
it's funny,
you probably know.
When I think of a sprain, like a sprained ankle, sprained knee, I always think of swelling. I never think of it as a tear. To me, a tear is a tear. You know what I'm saying?
Well, but the medial lateral, as you're probably aware, is of the three ligaments that you do have that, you know, keep the knee stable and in place. That's the one you can most afford to give up.
No, but I mean the term sprain. When
I think of
the term sprain, I don't think of a tear.
You think of a stretch.
A swelling.
A swelling, or it's a stretched ligament. Usually, is a sprained ligament.
Right. Right. Bruised.
The fact that
strained,
a grade 3 sprain really is sort of
it's a
misnomer.
It is a misnomer.
It is a torn MCL, but
it's
categorized.
It's
categorized, and again, I'm not an orthopedist, nor do I play one on the radio, but having had extensive work done on my knees, I can tell you that it's categorized as a sprain because it's not viewed as a vital ligament for your, shall we say, athletic
range
pleasure.
Of motion.
Yeah, for the range of motion. Yeah, that's true. Now, he will need some rest. It will probably be something that he will have to wear protection for once he does come back for the remainder of the season. It could very well be, depending upon what happens once he does return to action, it could be something that might be surgically repaired in the offseason.
If it's a tear, I would think
if it's a complete tear, as a grade three represents,
yep.
You would think that depending upon once the season's over and whether or not he's able to get through the rain in the season, they might decide to go in there and surgically repair it as opposed to letting nature.
Scoping
or something along those lines as opposed to letting nature take its course. Sometimes nature needs a helping hand,
yep.
Which,
yep.
Hey, we have the technology, as I said earlier. By God, let's do it. If we have it, why not? You know.
Well, if he, I guess the thinking is if he can play through the pain for half a season and then, you know, get it looked at. Then give Mother Nature the boost afterwards.
Right.
It might be worth it.
Sometimes, you know, with the surgery, you can help the healing process.
I wonder how many players who had that same type of injury, let's say before 1990, before arthroscopy became so widespread, how many of those type of injuries were, if not season-ending, but career-threatening.
I'd say most of them were season-ending. Almost all of them were season-ending. I don't know about career-threatening. It probably would take an ACL or an LCL to make it a career-threatening thing. But the medial is sort of the in-between. You got the arterial and you got the lateral, and the medial is kind of the one in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that, you know, actually, quite frankly, I think you can afford to do without.
Let's hear from the doctor.
Yes, doctor.
My sister, ironically, is an athletic trainer at the Stedman Hawkins Clinic out in Vail, Colorado.
So how far off base are we?
I'm actually going to send her some information right now.
She can diagnose it?
I'm going to see if she can give me a little more in-depth as opposed to what we've heard reported so far.
All right. That would be great.
So the doctor's going to page the nurse.
I'll get back to you.
Well, the doctor's going to repage the doctor, one or the other, right? Okay. So that works. Again, coming up in the second hour of the program, we'll be joined by, what did I say?
Lisa Zimmerman.
Well, thank you. Lisa Zimmerman.
I'm glad I asked you before the show.
I know. I've got 16 different things here right in front of my face. Lisa Zimmerman from CBSSports.com, who covers the Jets, and we'll officially turn our attentions and our focus to the Jets. But in the meantime, I did want to spend at least a little time again looking back at the game and figuring how this team can use this now as a stepping off point for 2009. Your emails, of course, are welcome and encouraged. Webradio@patriots.com is how you reach the program. The phone line is also available as well, 508-543-7482. Again, that's area code 508-543-7482.
John, I have a recommendation for you.
Go.
And it's for your health.
Yes.
Your own personal health.
Yes.
I hope you're not going to eat the rest of that pizza.
Is it bad?
No, the pizza itself is fine.
Oh,
but
just
you have it lying.
It was lying right there on the table?
On the counter, on the console, where Fred Kirsch sits all the time and makes an absolute mess.
Okay.
I would suggest using the cardboard box.
Okay.
From now
on. Or the
on.
Plates that are behind you.
Are there plates actually in here? Well, see, first of all, I was just totally and completely stunned. They're right there on top of the VCR.
Oh.
Perfect place for them, right?
Yeah. When are we getting that new fridge, by the way?
I've asked.
That's actually.
I'll follow up after you two. People are busy right now.
All right.
That's actually rather disgusting looking. But it would be nice to have something to drink, you know, around here again, so that would be good.
There's a great water cooler outside. Here, hang on one second. I'll take care of
you. No, it's all right. I'm good. It's fine. No, that's all right. Unfortunately for Jason, he's got so much to worry about now. They're putting all this stuff on his shoulders. It's just the way it works now. All right, so just sort of recapping a bit. Oh, man, you are unbelievable. Look at that.
Oh, what is this? Fancy
smart water? That's awesome. How great is that?
Troy Brown was on a radio station yesterday promoting a promotion that they're doing with Brady and a charitable organization in Boston.
Nice.
I don't really remember, but I'll get you the information. But they dropped off a case of Smart Water, so here
Beautiful.
We go.
Nice, sweet.
Hey, do we still have those granola bars?
Yeah.
Good.
After all, it is all about food.
Sure.
This show is no different from PFW Progress. It's all about food.
That's a little different.
Okay, we might not get into as much, Betty Rubble-ish stuff, but, you know, other than that, we're... By the way, that's so fitting. The more I think about it, I just laugh out loud.
It's funny because Barney Rubble sits across from
me. We got Barney and Betty Rubble on PFW Progress. I just thought you're right. That just dawned on me. I'm like, of course. Perfect couple. Absolute perfect couple. There's one other story that I wanted to talk about. And by the way, certainly your comments on the Bills game, number one, your thoughts on Jerod Mayo, and maybe what I'd like to enter into is what you think the Patriots should do to replace Jerod, at least in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
Should they go out and look for somebody? Should they move some players around? I know that Adalys Thomas actually ended up playing a little bit on the inside. Did he not on Monday night?
Yeah.
After Mayo went down?
I think at times. And that might have also been, you know, regardless of whether Mayo was hurt or not, that might have been part of the game plan, part of the scheme. That's something we'll never really know, of course, because the player's not going to talk about the game plan, and neither is Bill. But
oh, look at
thank
that.
You,
Nature,
Jason.
Nature Valley oats thank and honey. You, those are fantastic. That's stuff.
But, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. He's done it before. He's done it before here. And, you know, quite honestly, they're so thin, he's going to have to do something. At this point now, they're more they have more depth at the outside than they do on the inside. I would not be surprised to see them pick somebody up in the interim. You know, there's a rumor. I don't know if they talked about it on the other show, but the rumor I'm seeing out on the Internet, at least, is about Derek Brooks. Don't get your hopes up about Brewski. He's not coming back. He's retired. I'm taking him at his word. He's never coming back again.
Aren't you a little concerned, though, that another team hasn't picked up Brooks prior
well,
to this?
Well, Chicago, according to the report I read, Chicago had interest because of Urlacher going down, but then decided to hold off for whatever reason. There was nothing, you know, there was nothing specified as to why they decided not to. But I think it makes sense. You know, they're so thin. They need some help at that spot.
Right.
Not just a lack of depth, but some inexperience too.
Would Sale come back early? I know he's been quoted as saying he's good for about six games.
Well, if 6 to 8's all they need, then who knows? Maybe.
Well, I guess it wouldn't shock me to see them make a move. I think probably they should, considering the depth situation and the experience situation now is that much further weakened. And softened with Mayo's apparent time away. But I would be interested in knowing what you think maybe, you know, the team should do in Mayo's absence, if it should be by trade or by moving the roster around or by, you know, moving personnel around. Webradio@patriots.com is, again, how you reach the program, 508-543-7482 by telephone. Now, there's one story in the aftermath of the game on Monday night. That we've, I'm sure, have had a couple of emails about and has now made all the wire services. I picked this up, actually, from the Associated Press through ESPN.com, that I just think is an unbelievable indictment on how stupid some people really are.
You're talking about the Leodos McKelvin story?
Absolutely. And now the fact that Bills players are concerned, and I think perhaps rightfully
and they
so,
should be.
With their privacy and safety. If you hadn't heard, Leodos McKelvin, of course, is the cornerback and kick returner for the Bills that decided it was an ill-advised decision, but, you know, at the time he made the decision that he thought was best because he wasn't sure where his feet were in the end zone and all that stuff. He ran out on that kickoff with, 2 minutes to go, 2:06 to go, right? Yeah, it was 2:06 to go. When the Patriots scored to make it 24-19.
Correct. And then okay. The ensuing kickoff.
And then he came out, the ensuing kickoff, 2:06 on the clock, decided to run it out. He got hit by Brandon Merriweather, stopped him in his tracks, then got hit again. I think it was Pierre Woods that hit him again. And then ultimately Steve Gostkowski recovered
the
football.
Right.
And, of course, that's what allowed the Patriots to score the winning touchdown. And he's been completely and totally hammered by Bills fans to the point where his home – in Hamburg, or Hamburg, whichever you say. I guess it's Hamburg in Germany, right?
Yeah.
In Hamburg, New York, police there confirming that his home was vandalized.
What was the extent of the...
The vandalization?
Yeah.
Somebody had taken spray paint and put the score of the game and a very large, somewhat descriptive, graphic male organ, a painting of a male organ... on his front lawn. That's what they did. And the score.
It's despicable. I mean, I don't even know. First of all, it's a football game. Okay?
Yeah.
I realize fans get passionate and there's, you know, there's one thing, heat of the moment in the game, if you're a player, if you're a fan in the stands, or even if you're at home and you throw something at the TV or you smack the table or whatever. That should be the extent of your emotional reaction and involvement with any win or loss that your team has. Going out and physically trying to do harm to somebody is so egregious and uncalled for. I can't believe These people don't have the right to call themselves fans if they're going to do stuff like that.
Well, you know, here's the thing that Buffalo fans, and I think you probably would agree here, Eric, that Buffalo fans largely are looked at as being really some pretty doggone good fans. They've been very loyal to their team in the face of some unbelievable adversity over the years. I mean, how
you don't come with us on road trips, John.
Well, okay. All right. Fair enough. I mean, I've been to Buffalo a couple of times. I've been to the stadium, which is now Ralph Wilson Stadium. I've been to it once.
Our caravan usually gets... at some points we get items thrown at our caravan,
well,
which normally is not the case.
That happens,
and we always get hand signals and various other epithets yelled at us much more so than at other venues.
Buffalo?
In Buffalo, yes.
Well, I was always of the opinion that Buffalo fans, at least in terms of the games themselves, were actually fairly well behaved.
Maybe in the stadium, in the games. But when we show up, we always get it. I mean,
well, a lot of that probably is just an anti-New England stance, you know, because of
the
Patriots and their success. And the fact is that the Bills lost 4 straight Super Bowls, and I think that would frustrate anybody.
But I mean, threatening somebody's home and livelihood is—it's just there's no defending that under any circumstances. That's the overarching issue here, but. Second to that, and you alluded to it, John, McKelvin had to make a decision at the split second based on the information he had at the time, which was this. He wasn't sure in that split second when he caught the ball whether or not one or both of his feet were actually in the field of play at the time. And when he looked down, he was in the end zone. So he wasn't sure if he had caught it, say, at the 1 yard line and sort of his momentum carried him into the end zone, and then he decided to take a knee. That's a safety. So his decision
was,
not sure if that's going to do it. I'm not going to cost my team 2 points, and then that'll only cut the score to 3, and then all New England needs is a field goal. I'm going to take the ball out. What he should have done was done better to protect the ball and not fumble it, or as soon as he got, you know, as soon as a defender from New England came close to him, he should have just slid and gone down. Then at least your team has the ball and can maybe try to run the clock out.
Right.
Instead, he tried to get as much yardage as he could.
That was the worst decision.
You know, taking the ball out, if you're not sure about getting the safety, I think you have to take the ball out in that case.
Right.
But just, I it's inexcusable what these so-called fans did to him. It's just, nobody deserves that. It's a sport. It's a game. It's entertainment. You're not supposed to accost people because of it.
Bills linebacker Kavika Mitchell texted a couple of media sources after, you know, it became public that this had happened. He said, "With all the safety issues in the NFL, it's not funny at all. We have family at our homes to protect. If you show your face on my property, I'll make sure I do everything within my everything to keep my family safe." And frankly, I wouldn't blame him. Now you wonder. Mitchell said this.
Oh, Kavika Mitchell.
Kavika Mitchell said this. Now you start to get a bit of an idea of the mindset of not all, but some of the players who do stupid things like carry guns.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, hello, Plexico Burris. I mean, I realize he's probably a different story here, but this still plays into the mindset of, oh, I got to protect myself because nobody's going to look out for me.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, you know, this just perpetuates the problem that we have with some of these athletes because things like this happen, and then athletes said, well, you know, to hell with it. I'm going to take care of myself.
Yeah, I can totally see we live in a country where you have a right to carry firearms if you're so licensed, you know, and if somebody feels threatened, who are you to say that they can't do that? If he's licensed,
he should be able to do that. That's one of the founding tenets of where this country was brought, you know, onto this globe here, you know, and that's just, I totally agree with that assessment. You need to have the ability to do that.
And if players are getting harassed to this extent, I don't blame him at all if he feels like he needs to protect himself. If I came home to that, you know, the first thing I would do, John, is do exactly that. I would go and try to, you know, secure a license to try to protect myself and my family.
Well, that's probably why most of these guys probably have already done that. They're just not, you know, vocal or public about it.
The only benefit of the doubt I will give these people is that I will be willing to overlook some of it if this was done, and I imagine it was done in a drunken rage, and maybe they have very little memory of it. If this person was sober and did this in a premeditated fashion,
well, that person,
no excuse.
No, there's no excuse. That person should be brought up on charges.
Absolutely.
If you could find out who it is, of course, that's the other problem. All right, so I wanted to bring that up because I just thought it was an extraordinary story around a rather extraordinary game. And one of the things we do try to do here inside the playbook is talk about the stories within the story when we look back on the game. Because quite frankly, by the time we come on the air here and we talk about things, it's a good solid 48 hours plus. Usually, but right around 48 hours after the game's completion. So you've heard all the, well, why it happened and how it happened. So we try to look for the story within the story, read between the lines a little bit, and give you our opinions of how and why it might have transpired. And this was a perfect instance of, you know, some of the stories that kind of get beat down because of the actual score of the game.
And my post-game analysis that I did for the web, John, there were, like you said, so many storylines to this particular game. There was Mayo, there was, you know, shutting down T.O., there was Brady coming back and not looking too great and leading the comeback in the fourth quarter as he's done, you know, 29 times now in his career. One thing that I decided to focus on was something that I thought was probably the most incredible storyline of the game was that in crunch time, when they needed the two touchdowns to come back and win, Brady did not look for Randy Moss, who had 100 and some odd yards and had a great game, did not look for Wes Welker, who, you know, was as usual getting himself open, did not look for Kevin Faulk. He went to Benjamin Watson both times in the end zone. He was the primary receiver on both of those plays. It was the same play that they ran twice.
And the catch that Watson made.
The second one was
phenomenal. The second was, I think, and Brady had said this on Patriots Monday.
Best catch he's ever seen.
Best catch he's probably made in his career here. Yeah, it was a difficult catch to make.
Oh, absolutely.
Very difficult.
Well thrown. Thrown to the right spot, but incredible adjustment, turning counterclockwise to make the catch.
It was a Brady-like pass in a very un-Brady-like game to that point in time.
Yes. Yes, exactly. But this is a guy, 2 weeks ago, people expected him to either be cut or traded. I'm talking about Watson.
That's true.
And here he was the primary target
in
crunch time when the Patriots needed two touchdowns to come back and win the game.
That's right.
I thought that was just phenomenal. And that
That shows you the confidence that Brady has in him, number one.
Well, it shows that maybe finally in his sixth year we're seeing what we thought we were going to get in the past 5 years from Watson. Granted, it's one game, but
you can hope that that's
– You can hope that maybe that's that's a start.
That we're getting there. You can hope. I'm not sure that's the case, but, you know, again, I will allow that it's a step in the right direction, no question. As you suggested, that was the 29th career comeback win, a fourth quarter comeback win for Tom Brady in his career, and because of his overall performance, 39 of 53, 378 yards, and the two touchdowns, Brady was named the AFC Offensive Player of the Week. What was it, late yesterday, I guess, actually. So 13th time in his career that he's earned the AFC Player of the Week honor.
Yeah. And
pretty good way, when you look at it, you know, on the surface, pretty good way to come back in your first official game back in a year.
Yeah, and I think that probably played into it a little bit because I think to that point you could make an argument that he was very un-Brady-like. Now, most quarterbacks would take those stats in a heartbeat, but to me, some of his passes early on were way overthrown or underthrown, skip passes. He looked off, and he even admitted that he was off for most of the game. You know, that last 5 minutes, he was the Brady that we're used to, not a moment too soon, obviously.
He is also, and we've seen it quoted now several times in the local papers here, that it was vocal about his conversation with the team when he got into the huddle with five-plus minutes left. And he said, we're going to take this ball down there. We're going to score.
We're going to get the ball back.
We're going to get the ball back. We're going to score again, and we're going to win this thing.
Sure.
You know, so Brady was thinking like that. And when Brady speaks like that, it's pretty clear to see that these guys believe him.
Mm-hmm.
They not only believe that what he says isn't just so much cannon fodder, but they know they're going to come in and do that.
And
that just speaks absolute volumes to the extraordinary ability of the mind as well as, you know, the physical being as well.
Not just the fact that he came in and said it. This team is, you know, maybe more so than any other team, really puts an emphasis on situational football. And this is something that a lot of the players and even Bill talked about afterwards. When you do something over and over, repetition breeds, you know, a level of comfort and a level of familiarity. When you do something so much over and over again, it becomes routine. You don't get stressed out when it happens for real. Mm-hmm. And they practice the two-minute drill and the two-minute offense and running people in and out, substitutions, end-of-game scenarios. They do that kind of situational thing so often that when this came up in the game, it was very nonchalant. It was almost like practice. Okay, here's what's going to happen. Like you said, we'll go down and score. We'll get the ball back. We'll try to go and score again. It's almost like routine. It's not anything to get overly excited about. And that, I think, helps because when you're in those situations, the people who keep their heads are the ones who are
right.
More likely than not going to succeed.
Right. Where Benjamin Watson's concerned, his two touchdown catches equaling his total for the entire 2008 season, which I think is also...
He could have made a case for Offensive Player of the Week.
You could have. You could have made that case. And obviously Moss, too, for that matter, with 12 catches, 140 yards and such.
Tying a
141
career
yards.
Best, I believe,
tied a
for
career,
a single game.
Single game, career high for receptions, 12 passes, 141 yards that he caught. He had caught 12 for 204 yards playing for Minnesota against Chicago back in 1999. Brady's 39 completions, by the way, are the most in his career in a non-overtime game.
Yeah, he slung it a lot, especially in the second half.
And it ties his overall career high. He also had 39 completions against Kansas City back in 2002 in an overtime win here at Gillette Stadium.
And that's the thing. You know, I think we talked earlier in the show about the running game being lackluster. I think part of that was because they had to give up on the running game so quickly. They were down. They were behind. They were playing catch-up most of the time. And they needed, you know, they obviously the passing game was working, so they went to it a little bit more. But that's another thing I wanted to bring up. You know, Fred Taylor started the game and actually played most of the game at tailback. Maroney returned kicks and came in spot duty for Taylor. I actually thought Maroney... His numbers might not bear this out, but I think watching him run, I think he was a lot more decisive. He was doing the things that we said he needed to do. Make a decision, hit the hole, don't dance around too much. He made some great cutbacks, read his blocks very well. I thought it was one of his better efforts running the ball, even though he didn't have the huge numbers to back it up. And the same with Taylor. I think the reason they just had to abandon it was because they needed to get chunks of yardage in large amounts quickly. And the passing game was working. The Bills couldn't cover them. Any of the receivers. Mm-hmm. So part of that is because of what the score was. I think if it had been reversed, if New England had the lead most of the time, I think you would have seen a lot more substituting at running back, pounding the ball a little bit more, and it might have, the running game would have looked a little bit more impressive. The one thing I didn't like too much was you notice they did a lot of that unbalanced heavy formation where Matt Light would check in as an eligible receiver.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the line, they'd bring the rookie Sebastian Vollmer in at left tackle. That play wasn't really working. They used that about four or five times in short yardage situations, and it wasn't
right.
Doing the job, which is surprising because you put, you know, an extra tackle as a tight end and two tight ends mm-hmm. in that formation. You would think you're going to gain a little bit more than half a yard or so, but it for some reason the Bills were stuffing it every time.
By the way, here just along the lines of the Brady performance in that last five and a half, Dave from Pennsylvania says 5:32 left in the fourth quarter, down 11. If that was Matt Cassel going in to take the snaps, would he have been able to pull it out like Tom Terrific did? Because remember, a lot of the know-it-alls said during the offseason to trade Brady and sign Cassel.
Well, that's a good point.
I'm not sure that we would have gotten that. Ben in Douglasville, Pennsylvania. I'm a new listener that just got hooked on your podcast around the start of training camp. Can't believe I missed this for so long. Well, welcome, Ben. Anyway, keep up the excellent work. I listen via podcast since work doesn't allow me to listen live. I have one question about the game against Buffalo. Did having the same color helmets for both teams cause any issues for Brady? Also, did it cause any issues for the defense covering receivers?
I would tend to say no, because his errant passes weren't errant in the direction of other Bills players. They were just, you know, over the heads of receivers, out of bounds. They were skipped short. They weren't really in the right area where they were supposed to be. He wasn't throwing interceptions. You know, he wasn't really throwing to a Bills player who then, you know, maybe...
He was just low or inside or off with most of his passes.
A little too high or a little too low.
Right.
And who knows why? You know, he's human. Everybody has a bad night, a bad game. But the important thing is he fixed it in time, and when it was most critical, he was at his best.
Pete in the UK says, Eric, your write-up of the Bills-Pats game was terrific. Who would have thought that looks like Tarzan plays like Jane would be one of the stars of the game? I expected Watson to be on the Eagles by now instead of Smith. Maybe there's value in that first-round choice yet. As with Castle, Belichick clearly saw something that we mere mortals missed. To Coach Hoodie, we're not worthy.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was one of the big surprises of the game, in my opinion.
Yeah. Without a doubt.
A pleasant one, though. Pleasant surprise. And like I said, hopefully this is a portent of things to come for him. It's about time. It's been 5 years. We've been waiting on it for a while.
Yes, very true. Some would say it seems a lot longer. Dave in Palm Bay, Florida. Hi, this show is much better, less raunchy than the previous one.
Well, less raunchy for sure.
Well, I don't know. He hasn't given me any time yet to get raunchy.
Yeah, John
today.
Hasn't sworn at anybody
I haven't
yet.
Sworn anybody yet today. What do you guys think of Maroney? I have been a big supporter, and it is good to see him mature. That's what he says.
Well, again, we only have.
Has he matured?
As a football player or as a person?
Well, it'd be hard for me to really speak to his personality.
He's a great personality. Let me say
he
that.
Does.
He's
he does.
Very
but I don't
guy.
Know him well enough to know where, you know, if he's matured or not. So I can only speak to his performance as a football player.
I mean, he's not a get in trouble kind of guy.
No.
He's not a troublemaker kind of guy.
And I don't want to lead anybody to think that that's the case. Far from it. What I'm saying is that I think the jury is out on his maturation as a football player, because I still saw some of the old Lawrence habits of, you know, sticking his neck in and then dashing out, you know, in that second half against Buffalo. And granted, that may have been what the defense presented. But sometimes you just want to see a guy stick his nose in there, whether he has it or not. And that's something that Maroney has never been able to do.
I was very impressed with his kickoff return.
Yes.
I think we need to see more of that. It's unfortunate that the rest of the game, the Bills decided to kick to Kevin Faulk, because I think Maroney, you know, and they did that purposely because I think Maroney was going to hurt them. He's great in the open field, hard to take down. And that opening kickoff when he leaned his shoulder in at the end and drilled, I think it was Lindell, who that was the last line of defense.
Ryan Lindell, yes, correct.
I mean, great effort by Maroney. Didn't just run out of bounds, got it to about midfield. I think if we can get him more touches like that in the kick return game, I think that will carry over confidence-wise when he does get his chances to carry the ball. And I think it showed a little bit. You're right. It wasn't a perfect game, but I think he has shown, at least so far. It's very early, obviously, but there's more potential for him too. He and Watson both. I think this could be important years for both of them.
I wanted to point out also, Eric, before we wrap up the first hour here. I wanted to point out a couple of other offensive highlights anyway, just because, again, we very rarely get a chance to sort of point these things out because we get lost in the whole win and loss thing. But before we do that, let's get to who's that on the loan?
Steve.
Thank you. Steve is in New Hampshire, right? Steve.
Yeah.
Welcome inside the playbook. What's on your mind?
Hey, John. How you doing?
Great.
Hey, Eric.
Steve, do you have your two beers?
Oh, yeah. No, not yet. But I did want to touch on what John just talked about as far as Lawrence Maroney. I didn't bring it up to you guys, you know, when I went through my little punch list. But I do agree. There was at one point, you know, I thought Maroney did, you know, fairly well. I mean, you know, obviously the kickoff in the beginning of the game was like brilliant. He just, you know, that lifted you. But I thought he, you know, ran well. But what I'd like to say, and what John was just saying, you know, in my mind, as I watched him run, each time I said to myself, you know, if Ben Jarvis Green Ellis was in there, even though it's not his fault that the, you know, that defensive line got to get into the backfield, I said to myself, at least Ben Jarvis would have exploded into somebody and probably at least got two, maybe three, maybe even hit a gap and found a hole. And I think that's the thing that Lawrence Maroney does. He looks and thinks instead of looks and goes. Does that make sense to you guys?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. He dances around a lot because he's indecisive.
Yeah, but, like, you know, when you look at it, like I said, and I watched it, and I literally said to myself, watching him do it, and I went, geez, you know, I think Benny, he would have got something out of it. Not, you know, at least got back to the line of scrimmage, you know, and I wouldn't ask for more than that anyway, because that, you know, that defensive line did get in there. But I honestly think he's just got this little. And that, like, I talked to Eric, you guys, PFW, you know, months ago, going, you know, thank God we got Fred Taylor, and I really think he's going to learn from Fred Taylor, and I hope it's going to happen, you know. And, you know, and like anything, you know, it's going to take 3 to 4 weeks before any of us know anything about this team anyway.
Well, I'd agree with that. I hope that maybe some of Fred Taylor can rub off on him, and I was a little curious why Taylor didn't see more action in the second half, to be honest with you.
Well, I think, as we mentioned, the score dictated that.
Okay.
They needed to get points in a hurry, and they needed to get chunks of yardage in a hurry. And Kevin Faulk is your third down or pass catching back. So it's not a.
That went without saying. That's right. Exactly what had to happen. But even at that, you know, in the preseason, you know, Lawrence did some great job of, you know, a couple of receptions on screens and stuff. So I was surprised they didn't use him a little more doing that too. But it doesn't matter. But, you know, the point I wanted to make is I agree with John when he started talking about it. You know, Lawrence has got to get that, you know, just don't think. Just, you know, I mean,
just go.
The play is drawn on the paper. You learned it. And you're supposed to go between A and B or B and C. Well, if he's in the way, then hit him in the back. And you've heard how many linemen say when they got great running backs behind him, you know, I'm getting this guy out of the way because if I don't, I know I'm going to get nailed.
Yep, very
true.
Know?
Because you know, your great running back will nail his lineman if he didn't clear the hole because that's where he was supposed to go. And I just hope Lawrence really figures that out. And I hope, you know, 4 or 5 weeks from now we can go, he figured it out.
We're going to keep our fingers crossed on that
one,
Steve.
You know, he's 24 years old. I think he can get it.
Absolutely.
You know? He's definitely got the talent. That's the hot side.
Well,
that's why everybody's upset, because he's got the talent.
You're right. We have seen that, and I appreciate your phone call. Thank you for the time. It's great to have your input on the show. I'd like to say that I could be all positive about the direction that, you know, Lawrence Maroney and his football career is heading. But, I mean, Eric, you know as well as I do that, you'd especially know as well as I do that last year on this program, I was not a Maroney fan. In fact, I was ready to call him a bust last year. And I said, you know what, in all fairness and with all due process, because, you know, we knew he was hurt last year. We just didn't know the extent of his injury. It basically was a broken shoulder is what he was playing with last year.
Right.
I said, all right, I'm willing to give him that, you know, next year, that third year, hopefully a healthy year that he can come in and produce before I'm, you know, give him the, you know, no longer give him the benefit of the doubt and call him a bust.
Right.
Lawrence Boney Maroney.
So I just, which, by the way, is still one of his all-time worst nicknames. So,
what?
You know, I guess I'll adhere to that. But once we get to, you know, the middle part of this season, everything's off the table.
Yeah.
I mean, everything's off the table. I haven't seen it yet. You're right about the kick returns. That was a positive step. Maybe that's more his role than being an every down, you know, type of back. I mean, I'd be perfectly happy with Fred Taylor and Kevin Faulk back there, you know, as running backs. And let's not forget Sammy Morris, who I think Sammy Morris,
sure,
if he can stay
sure
healthy,
yep,
I think he's more than adequate, mm-hmm, you know, as the change of, or as a complement to Fred Taylor.
Mm-hmm. It's a committee. The backfield has been a committee for the last
few years.
And
Ben Jarvis Green-Ellis, you know, for all the wonderful things that he's been able to produce. He was inactive for the game, and I think they look at him more as the eventual
long-term
Kevin Faulk type role.
Maybe.
It makes perfect sense to me.
Maybe.
Makes perfect sense to me.
Yep.
And he probably has ability to run with the ball even better than Kevin does. You know, sometimes it turns out that way. All right, so thank you for being here in the opening hour of the program, but
we'll
stick around.
Tomorrow.
Yes, sir. We'll be back tomorrow Inside the Playbook. We have hour number two of Patriots Playbook coming up after a short timeout. We've got some more emails to share with you. I believe did we get inside the locker room today? We did not?
We did get in the locker room.
Yeah,
you also have a guest.
Report?
Yeah, I know you have at least practice report, but we also had interviews inside the locker room that we're going to get in hour number two as well. So that's coming up. But what was the practice report?
Mayo was the only one
right
not there.
Yep.
It was a shorts and shells kind of practice, right, so no heavy hitting. That was really the news of the day. No Mayo. Everyone else was there.
No Mayo on the bread today.
Thanks, Eric.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Well, there we go. And as we reported off the top of the program, is now being reported by multiple sources, it's a grade 3 medial collateral ligament sprain. A grade 3 sprain is actually a complete tear of the MCL, and the normal downtime, and I say normal with quotations around the word normal because there's no real way of knowing who's normal or what's normal nowadays, but the expected absence is 6 to 8 weeks. And again, if that's all, if everything goes well between now and, probably the midseason point here. Web radio at patriots.com, 508-543-7482. That's the telephone number. We get back to your emails, and we will also have Ms. Zimmerman from CBSSports.com coming up to talk about the New York Jets inside the playbook.
At American Airlines, we know it seems like you're on the road almost as much as your favorite sports team. We know you've scheduled a business trip to a city where your team happens to be playing that night. And we know that on every trip, you inevitably forget to bring a toothbrush. But you never forget that old pair of socks you wear on game day to bring your team luck. We know for you, it's not just a seat on a flight to a place. It's a seat on a flight to your life. We know why you fly. We're American Airlines.
Hey, don't go yet, sir.
But the light turned green.
Well, you don't go till I say so. You play by my rules. My rules. Ball start, loss of 5 yards, still first down.
What are you talking about?
Unsportsmanlike conduct, 10 yards.
Unsportsmanlike is 15 yards.
Move the chains!
You are a crossing guard.
Personal foul, 15 yards.
And stop blowing that whistle.
Think football? Bank football. Get Patriots banking only from Bank of America. Get the Patriots logo on your checks, debit card, and your Patriots Extra Points credit card. Use Extra Points rewards to get tickets or even stand on the sidelines during pregame warmups. Plus, you get a bonus match on your Keep the Change savings. To get Patriots banking, go to a banking center or bankofamerica.com/patriots.
Delay of game,
but,
5 yards,
but
first down.
But you're not...
Keep the Change patent pending. Credit card programs are issued and administered by FIA Card Services N.A. Bank of America N.A. member FDIC. Copyright 2009. Bank of America Corporation.
Man, it's football season. I mean, usually the house is decked out by now. You know, and the football lamps and the big wall posters.
Dude, it is decked out. But this year, I'm working on a higher level.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it.
Well, you're just not on that level. I've got Razor Sharp Fios TV from Verizon, so I don't just watch the game. I feel like I'm in it. The whole place has ultra-quick Fios internet, so my computer becomes my own personal press box.
So, no little football helmet soaps in the bathroom this year?
Sadly, no. But with ESPN MVP, I get stats, scores, and highlights sent straight to my wireless phone.
With Verizon's Fios TV and internet, plus wireless apps like ESPN MVP, you have everything you need to take your football experience to the next level. Verizon, official telecommunications provider of the New England Patriots. Select VCast phone and VPAC subscription required. Fios available in select areas.
You are so far beyond football-shaped serving trays.
Well, it's that time of year again where Sunday means you're doing something football. Whether it's tailgating in the parking lot, throwing the pigskin around, or just hanging in and watching the game on the tube, it's all about football. And when you're not watching football or playing football, well, I think we both know you're thinking football. And all that can make you a little hungry. That's why there's the tasty snack wrap from McDonald's. Snack wraps now come in your choice of three flavors. New Chipotle barbecue, honey mustard, and ranch. And they're available with grilled or crispy chicken. Delicious and easy to eat. It's the perfect game time snack. So grab one today. And when you do, if you're looking at that chicken select and it kind of reminds you of a quarterback in the middle of the pocket, except now he's surrounded by cheddar jack cheese, ranch sauce, and lettuce, well, maybe you're thinking just a little too much about football. McDonald's. I'm loving it.
Hour number two inside Patriots Playbook here on the American Airlines Patriot.com radio. How about that? A sponsor and everything.
Nice plug.
Oh, well, you know what? You got to do what you got to do, brother. Right? That's what it's all about. I want to make sure my check doesn't bounce. Oh, but am I getting paid for this?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yes, in some form or fashion, I know I am. Before we get a hold of Lisa Zimmerman, a couple of other things from the Bills game that I wanted to share with you here. Offensive highlights. And again, just because they're significant in the numbers, as unbelievable as this offense has been over the course of the last couple of years in terms of its prolificness, is that a word? It is now. I wanted to share these facts with you that On Monday night, it was the first time in Patriot history for two players to have 12 catches in a ballgame. Both Moss and Wes Welker each had 12 receptions for the Patriots, which ties the team's fifth highest single-game reception total. It's the first time in team history that two players have had at least 12 in the same game. The last time the Patriots had two or more players with at least 10 catches was almost 15 years ago. It was November the 13th of 1994 when Leroy Thompson, remember him, anybody? Leroy Thompson had 11 catches and Ben Coates had 10. And Michael Timpson, remember him, anybody? Michael Timpson had 10, and this was all in a 26-20 overtime win over Minnesota. Moss had his 60th career 100-yard receiving game, which is second now all-time in NFL history. Jerry Rice has 76 of those, so Moss now has 60. Moss also moving up the all-time NFL reception list. He is 13th, finishing the night now with 855 career catches. He is seven shy of the number 12 place finisher on that list, Jimmy Smith. Let's see. Was there anything else I wanted to share with you? Patriots 8-0 in home openers since moving to Gillette in 2002. The 50th season opening contest. The team now is 26-24 all-time in season opening games. And let's see. Tom Brady, 24 career 300-yard passing games. The Patriots are 22-2 when Tom Brady throws for 300-plus yards in a game. If you were wondering, and I was actually earlier, and this answers my question, Drew Bledsoe has the team record of 26 300-yard regular season passing games. So Tom is two away from matching that. The game was Brady's 21st straight regular season win as a starting quarterback. The Patriots have won all 18 regular season games in which both Tom Brady and Randy Moss have started. Think about that for a second. They've won all 18 regular season games in which both Brady and Moss have been in the starting lineup. Wonder how that sits in Oakland. Seven career games against Buffalo, by the way. Moss has now had five 100-yard receiving games. And Brady is now 14-1 all-time in his career as a starter against Buffalo. Patriots' overall win streak against Buffalo now is 12 straight, which dates back to 2003 when the Patriots last lost to Buffalo 31-0 in the then-season opener in Buffalo. So it is the longest winning streak against a single opponent in Patriot history, and that tops the record of 11 straight wins against an opponent, which was achieved against the Bills from 82 to 87. So they've beaten Buffalo now 12 straight times. You know, I remember thinking, in that five-minute span left to go in the fourth quarter, the Patriots were down by 11. I remember thinking, well, you know what? They've beaten them 11 straight times. You can't beat them every time you play them. That's the first thing I thought of. Because I had known, we talked about this last week, I had known that, you know, hey, this was 11 straight games, 11 straight wins that they've had over Buffalo. I mean, that's extraordinary, especially when you consider that it's a divisional opponent, so you're going to see this team twice a season. And you've still beaten them 11 straight times because, you know, they know you, you know them, and you've still beaten them 11 straight times. Let's just think about it. That's just stupid. How does that happen? A lot of luck has to go into a lot of the preparation for that to happen in this day and age of parity in the NFL. And certainly, I think we can all agree, as we begin now to transfer away from Buffalo and move toward the New York Jets this week, I think we can all agree that there was a certain amount of luck on the side of the Patriots on Monday night. Now, I've always been a proponent of the saying, good teams know how to manufacture their own luck, and good teams know how to create that opportunity that is perceived or understood as being luck. Good teams put themselves in position to be lucky. And I'm still convinced that that's happened. I think that was an absolute certainty on Monday night. And teams that aren't lucky, teams that are snake bit, teams that have fallen on difficult times, like you'd have to categorize the Bills as being, they get to a point where they doubt whether or not they can come back and do one thing or another. I got a text message right after the game was over with from a friend of mine who is a dyed-in-the-wool Bills fan, of all things. And he actually had tickets to the game, and he was sitting in the 200 section. And he texted me right after the game was over. And the first words on his text were, "Great game." He was very upbeat. He was, he was not depressed or disappointed or morose or suicidal or anything, as you might think that some Buffalo fans would be, especially the one that decided to, vandalize Leotis McKelvin's property in Buffalo. But my friend was completely the opposite. He said, "You know, I've been a longtime Bills fan," and he said, "I'm used to the heartbreak, and I'm used to the collapses, and I'm used to the falling short." And he said, "I choose not specifically to be that way because ultimately I wouldn't be a fan." He said, "But I can appreciate the fact that it was a great game, number one, because I didn't expect it going in, and number two, that I saw more out of the offense that I had seen the entire preseason, and number three, that even though they had a linebacker go down with an injury in Paul Posluszny, and it looks like he could be out longer than Jerod Mayo could be out because he broke his arm again. You recall that's the injury that knocked him for a loop, what was it, a year, 2 years ago, a couple years ago? And took him out for the season." So they also had their injury problems. He said, in spite of all of that, and they only threw to T.O. what, three times, and he caught two balls? Said, "I'm encouraged by what I see." And I texted him back, and I said, "Yeah, it was a good game." I said, "The Patriots played poorly, but that takes nothing away from the Bills." And I said in my text, I could probably dig it up here, but it'll just waste everybody's time here. I said in my text, I thought the Bills had an outstanding game plan. And it took the Patriots a while to adjust. Now, in the opening hour of our program today, we talked a lot about, with Eric Scalavino from PFW, we talked about the Patriots' game plan upon further review and reflection here, giving it, our, 2-day cushion as we normally do around here, actually worked pretty well. Their job was to take the speed and the athleticism of those Buffalo wide receivers away from Trent Edwards and make Trent Edwards and the running backs and the tight ends beat them. They made them, they wanted those guys to beat them in a methodical setup, which is why you saw Fred Jackson, turn out to be something considerably on par with, if not even a little bit better than, Marshawn Lynch, in replacing Marshawn Lynch in the Bills lineup. Patriots didn't have an answer for Jackson, so you have to give Jackson and Edwards credit for taking advantage of what the Patriots defense was allowing them to have. They did, and it almost won them the game. Patriots are very fortunate. But then the breaks evened up. Brady threw a pick six, and McKelvin fumbled, on a kickoff that allowed the Patriots to ultimately win the game. So the breaks evened up. Now, I would still argue that, and of course both teams lost a key component of their defense during the course of the game. Both teams had, some crucial penalties, although, the two penalties on the Patriots that were flagged ultimately I thought were ridiculous, but breaks do even out. They do have a way of evening out. And the only thing that you can hope when the entire wash comes out, the only thing you really hope as a fan here is that the breaks find a way to even themselves out. You're going to get some. The other guy's going to get some. You only have to hope that the other guy doesn't get more breaks than you. That all things being equal, if the breaks are even, that your team is on the plus side of the scoreboard, and that's precisely what happened on Monday night. Now, I've seen a couple of, power rankings, and we jump into that, here inside the playbook from time to time with the various, websites and news sources are reporting as the top teams in the NFL and their power ratings and rankings, all that stuff. And, it's good, fodder, talk show fodder. It's good for, things that we do here and, for fan participation, all that kind of stuff. I mean, because, there's no such thing as a ranking in the NFL. We all know that. The action is decided, and their ultimate prize decided right there on the field. Unlike, the college game. But I've seen a couple of the pundits already sliding the Patriots down from what was a pretty much either a consensus number two to start the season behind the defending champion Pittsburgh, which I had no problem with because, as many of you know, I'm an old school kind of guy, and I believe that the defending champion stays the champion until the champion is beaten. So as far as I'm concerned, Pittsburgh can stay ranked number one in the power rankings all season long. Unless, of course, they go on a losing streak. Ultimately, they'll have a chance to defend anyway, as long as they get into the postseason. But a couple of those pundits have slid the Patriots down from 2 down to like 3, 4, or even 5. I saw that from John Clayton and on ESPN.com. You've probably seen that already, or some of you certainly have. And, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, it's good for conversation, but I mean, really, you know, what are they trying to do? They're trying to give you a snapshot of the relative strengths and weaknesses of all 32 teams in the NFL at, bang, this moment's notice. That doesn't mean it's going to stay that way tomorrow. It certainly doesn't mean it's going to stay this way next weekend or next Monday or Tuesday as we're talking about this coming week's game. It's a snapshot. Fact is that had the Patriots lost that game, you would have seen people dumping on New England left and right. They would have gone from being the flavor du jour to yesterday's meatloaf real fast. So take it with a grain of salt. Have some fun with it. Agree to disagree if you like in terms of the opinions of some of these so-called experts that are out there analyzing and such. But fact is that it all eventually does come out on the wash. The other thing that I wanted to mention about Monday night's game was the Patriots were perfect in red. Now, I got, you know, as the offense, you know, of course, they're wearing the throwbacks. And by the way, if you saw the game, which I assume many of you did, I loved seeing the red jerseys. I loved seeing the old Pat Patriot on the helmet. I love the fact that the game was billed as the Boston Patriots versus the Buffalo Bills, you know, in terms of the whole AFL legacy thing. That was really cool.
You even said it really nicely at the top.
Thank you. I did. Well, it's because that's the way we should do it. I mean, it's an AFL legacy game. We're celebrating, you know, 50 years of professional football, not only in this area, but, you know, the advent of the American Football League in 1960 changed professional football and led us to the path that we're on today. A lot of people say that the NFL might not be as popular now as it is, as being, I think, you know, not only the number one sport here in this country, but globally increasing by leaps and bounds in terms of popularity. Let's just ask our good friends from over the other side of the pond about that, which we have a very dedicated, you know, fan base, and we're very thankful for those of you in the UK. I have to tell you that, the AFL changed everything. And so we are celebrating the AFL, you know, and I believe the Patriots get to wear the throwbacks, what, 6 times this year? 3 times this year. Is it 3 home, 3 away?
4 total.
4 total.
2 and 2.
All right, I was off. 2 and 2. Thank you. But 4 times total this year, which is great. Loved seeing it. But I have to admit, the cynic in me thought in the first half when the team was down at halftime that, you know, well, it's great that they're playing in the Reds. Now if they could just stop playing like the old Patriots in the Reds, I think we'd all be in better shape here. Come on. You had to thought the same thing. Admit it. Somebody thought the same way as I did. Oh, they're playing in the Reds. Why are they playing like the Patriots used to play when they were in the Reds? Nevertheless, the last time the Patriots wore the red jerseys at home was 1992, the season-ending overtime loss to Miami at Old Foxborough Stadium. The Patriots wore their throwback jerseys in a home game for the first time as well since 1994. October the 2nd of 94, when they had the white throwbacks against the Green Bay Packers in a 17-16 win over the Packers, again, at Foxborough. That was a league-wide initiative in recognition of the NFL's 75th anniversary season 15 years ago. Patriots, the last time they wore their throwbacks in any game was in 2002 at Detroit. You might recall that was a Thanksgiving Day game against the Lions. They wore red jerseys modeled after those worn by the 1985 AFC champs that year. So they hadn't worn any kind of throwbacks in 7 seasons, but hadn't won anything at home resembling those old uniforms since 1994. So it had been a long while since we had seen those old unis, and it was actually pretty cool to see that. I have one other thought, and it really doesn't have so much to do with the game as it has to do with the overall state of the franchise right now. That of the 53-man roster from opening day last year, comparing this year's roster to last year, and, of course, during the course of the year last year, how many times did we in this program talk to you and talk to each other about, you know, this team had to get younger, this team had to get faster, this team needed to get younger specifically on defense? And certainly they made big strides throughout the course of the offseason. Obviously, defensively now, there's almost a total makeover compared to what it was a year ago, right? We did talk about this a lot, correct? Well, comparing the opening day rosters from this year to last year, there are 23 new Patriots on the 53-man roster from opening day last year. 17 of those 23 new faces saw action in their first regular season game as a member of the Patriots. That is a lot of changeover. That's basically one-third, one out of every three players is new or different and saw playing time Monday night against Buffalo as compared to this time 1 year ago. One out of every three, new. That's changeover. I almost want to think, and I almost want to say that's too much changeover, that it's a little bit more than they should have bitten off and chewed. Specifically, I said this last week, I'll say it again after watching that second game on Monday night, I think they gave up on Richard Seymour too early. I understand why they did it, when they did it. I understand all the monetary ramifications. I cannot say that it was a bad business decision. It was a good business decision, especially considering what they got back. But I am one for winning here and winning now when you have the tools to win here and now, because it's so hard to win even when you have all the tools in this league. And so why give up one of those things that is going to have a major impact in whether you win or lose? Because you don't know what will happen 2 years from now. We don't know what the landscape will be in the NFL. The Patriots, it is a calculated gamble, what they did. There's just no other way to look at it. It is a calculated gamble. And to me, that's very un-Patriot-like in my way of thinking. This team has taken great pains to being methodical and thorough in its preparation, both off the field as well as on the field. And this whole move of Richard Seymour, again, while I understand the monetary ramifications and why they made the move they did and Oakland throwing a one at him, hey, you know what? I can't say that I wouldn't have made the same decision. I cannot say that. I'm glad I didn't have that decision to make. But I will remain consistently steadfast in my opinion. I think they gave up on Richard Seymour too early. I hope it does not cost them a legitimate shot at the Super Bowl. But I know for a fact that it has made them not as good a defense. And it was interesting to see Seymour have a little in his tank for Oakland, as Oakland almost beat and probably should have beaten San Diego in the second game of that Monday Night Football doubleheader. TV ratings were, by the way, boffo. Television term, boffo for the Patriots and Bills. Strong ratings, very strong ratings, an all-time rating as well. So it was all good. It was all good.
It was huge locally, too.
I believe that. Didn't Channel 5 carry the ESPN broadcast locally? Is that?
Five, ESPN and MUR.
And MUR in Manchester, right,
New Hampshire. Huge number.
Yeah, so not surprising. That's great. It would have been a crushing defeat, but we'd still probably be, you know, hemming and hawing over to this point in time had it turned out the other way. But fortunately for the Patriots, they're 1-0. And as we all know, this is a 17-week, counting the bye week, a 17-week marathon in the NFL. And you're just ready to kind of take it and move on. We got to take it and move on. And that's what they are. They're 1-0. All right, let's get to a couple of other emails here. And again, webradio@patriots.com is how you reach the show. 508-543-7482. The telephone number, Lisa Zimmerman, in just a few more minutes here. Hopefully, here by the bottom of the hour, she'll be joining us. This one comes from Mark. Mark is writing us from the UK, and he says, John and Eric, I like you guys. I'm happy to be 1-0. Did you guys feel like me that the play calling on Monday night was overly conservative? As a team, we definitely need to have a look at bringing someone in at linebacker. If just one more linebacker goes down, we're in big trouble with McKenzie and Crable out injured as well with zero depth. But to be honest, there isn't exactly a great deal of talent out in the free agent market. It seems like the depth of personnel available to pick up diminishes every year. Is that just me or is that a growing trend? No, I think I actually think you kind of hit it on the head there, Mark. I actually think it's part of the trend that everybody's looking for depth. Everybody's trying to stockpile it as they can. Everybody has injury problems, so it appears to everybody that there's just not as much depth. And, in fact, I don't think it's an appearance at all. I think it's a fact. There's just not as much quality depth. Why do you think the Patriots last year called back Junior Seau and Roosevelt Colvin? They wanted somebody to be able to come in who understood the schematics of what they were doing defensively rather than having to teach that to someone right off the bat and spend time teaching. They want someone who's, you know, got the learning curve already beaten here. So don't be surprised. Don't be surprised if Seau gets the call here. Now, I cannot substantiate anything where Derek Brooks is concerned and that particular, you know, online rumor. Wouldn't surprise me if that happened. But, again, you know how the Patriots are with the way they do things. Don't be shocked to see a name that is familiar to you, more so than Derek Brooks, is in terms of having been, you know, familiar with the Patriots playbook. Coming in here, if indeed the Patriots decide to make that move.
Teddy Bruschi, Arizona.
I don't know, you know, and I kind of feel like Eric. I'm going to take Bruschi at his word that he's retired. He has signed a deal with ESPN. He was on the field after the game, you know, on the set there in the north end zone, you know, by the tower and the bridge. And I'm going to take him at his word that he's going to stay retired. I don't know that if he has a clause in his contract with ESPN that would allow him, you know, to go back to football if the situation presented itself. Knowing ESPN as I do, and knowing some of those contracts as I do, having been intimate with some of those contracts as I have before, I would be shocked if ESPN allowed that to happen in a contract. I'd just be shocked. Because when ESPN grabs you, they grab you, and they don't let you go. They just don't. They like to basically chew you up, run you through the car wash, as we call it, and then spit you out.
Don't they rule the world?
Pretty much. I do have to admit, though, that even though, you know, our website here is the best thing going for Patriots news and information, obviously, it's the source, Patriots.com. I have glanced onto ESPNBoston.com. Last couple of days just to see it because it's obviously a new launch in terms of the local sites that ESPN is doing. They've had the ESPN Chicago site up for quite a while now. It's interesting. A lot of it is, unfortunately, to my way of thinking, already knowledge that I have. I'm not getting anything new. What I have gotten new is Mike Reese, who's been a contributor of this program in the past through his work through the Boston Globe and Boston.com. And ESPN signed Mike Reese to basically do the same thing that he has done for the Boston Globe and Boston.com, to do the same thing for ESPNBoston.com. And that's his blog, and which a lot of people, a lot of Patriots fans like, and rightfully so. He does a magnificent job of covering. And basically is be the Patriots beat reporter for that website. And, you know, obviously Mike does a superb job. I hope that we can get Mike on this program again. Jason?
We actually talked to Mike about that a couple weeks ago, and yeah. He said he was kind of doing double duty with the launch of ESPN Boston and his stuff at the Globe. And maybe he asked me to let things calm.
Yeah,
and
once we get into the season.
More than happy to join you on the playbook.
Good. Yeah, thought so, because he's done it before, and he's been great at it before, and he does such a thorough job in his reporting. It would be excellent to have someone with his repertorial skills, you know, contribute to the program from time to time. So that's what we're looking at here. Mark continues by saying, I rate the Jets O-line as up there as one of the best units right now in the league, which is a great place for Sanchez to learn his trade. I feel we may really struggle getting pressure, which could expose our secondary even more. I also agree with that, Mark. One of the things that concerns me about Monday night was the fact that until late in the game, we didn't get the kind of pressure on Trent Edwards that we needed to get. And this is coming against an offensive line that was already maligned in the preseason. Young, haphazard, basically patched work offensive line that Buffalo had, and we really didn't do any tremendous damage until late in the game. Now, that may have been partly by design. Again, I will allow for that, based on the way that they were trying to contain. That was the thought process, contain Buffalo on Monday. But I think we need to put the hats on and come after Mark Sanchez. Otherwise, with a better offensive line, I think you're absolutely right. I think the Jets could have some success there. The quick lateral passes from Brady to Welker, are they in danger of being overused? We've seen a lot of them over the last two seasons. The Bills look like they keyed onto them straight away. Do you think as much as our offense is great, there's a danger of it becoming one-dimensional? No, because that's what the Bills were giving us. Bills were giving us. And anytime, you know, a team is going to give the Patriots that, the Patriots have exactly the type of weapons they can use to get to take what other teams are giving you. So if they're going to give the Patriots the short underneath stuff, then by God, they're going to take it. They're going to take it with Welker. You're going to see more Falk. You're just going to see the Patriots take what the opposing team gives them. And the good thing about that is that, you know, those guys can break plays. They can turn, you know, a 7 yard over the root middle into, you know, something that goes 20, 30 yards or more. Mark, thanks for the email. He says, John, are you loving your UK following? Absolutely, brother. Way to go. Way to be on top of it, and I appreciate your listening and contributing. David writes back, he says, yes, I did mean football-wise, and yes, I am seeing him also thinking, then going. I'm talking about Lawrence Maroney as we opened up in the opening hour here. But it seems like the line is more used to pass blocking, not run blocking. That's partly it. You know, pass blocking is sort of an acquired technique, while run blocking is more relying on raw ability and power. I don't think there's an offensive line alive that would tell you they would rather pass block than run. Most guys would rather be moving forward than moving backwards. I think they'd much rather be run blocking. But the way the Patriots have things set up, you know, they're not doing that. I don't think that means they can't do it. It just means that's kind of their style of play. Paul in London, lots from the UK today. Way to go over there. Hey, guys and gals, another international shipping question. Another website called Football Fanatics do a delivery of NFL, college, NHL merchandise to overseas countries for $19.99. I'm in the UK and receive delivery in 7 to 10 days for $20. Oh, okay. This is for Shop Talk. You know what? I'm going to leave this for the Shop Talk guys. All right, so Paul, there
you go. Way to read the subject line.
Says Shop Talk question.
What show is this?
Playbook. Oh, I forgot we had a show called Shop Talk. What can I tell you? That's right. It comes on right after this one, so I'll leave that for them.
Good promo.
Yeah, thank you. So there's a method to my madness here. Even in my stupidity, Jason, there's a method to my madness.
I never said stupidity.
Denseness? Well, that's okay.
I didn't say that either.
No, but you certainly alluded to that.
I'm not Andy Hart.
Hello, John and Eric. It's good to have Nitpick Tuesdays back, even if it's a Wednesday. That's right. That's right. Nitpick Tuesdays. Thank you, Alejandro, for realizing it's Nitpick Tuesday. That's usually what we do. And, in fact, we'll have technically our first Tuesday show next Tuesday since the Patriots get a chance to play on Sunday this weekend. So normally in the past, our first day has been a Nitpick day where we pick through all of the foibles of the previous Sunday's game and sort of figure out what we could have done right as opposed to what the team could have done or what they did wrong and how things could be corrected in your opinion. So we'll look forward to having that coming up again next Tuesday. But Alejandro says, my first pit nitpick has to do with the WEEI guys. Kickoff weekend, Monday night at home with the return of one of the best quarterbacks in league history who somehow pulls out an unlikely fourth quarter comeback in a one-point win, and they find a way to squeeze in interleague play? Come on. So, well, I can't do anything about WEEI's programming here, Alejandro. He says, I was stunned throughout the game mainly because I had bought all the pregame analysis that predicted a comfortable victory. I was mad after the game, but then I realized there was not much to complain about. Take a look. You can't complain about the play calling. Patriots always gamble all those types of fourth downs. Plus, turning the ball on downs avoids the dangerous return of the Bills' special teams. He says, quoting Denny Green, they are who we thought they were. They only gave up 17. We already knew that the offense better put more than that on the board, and Owens and Evans, both deep threats, were non-factors. Patriots are a work in progress. They will get better. Alejandro, thanks for contributing. All right, joining us on the phone line now is Lisa Zimmerman of CBSSports.com, who covers the Jets amongst her duties for that website. Lisa, John Rook here inside the playbook. Thanks for taking a couple of minutes today.
Hi, John. My pleasure. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. Can I get your reaction, first of all, to everything that's being reported, not only on your own website, but everything else that ever seems to be out there now on, looks like Jerod Mayo being out 6 to 8 with a grade 3 MCL sprain, and what you think that might mean short-term for this football team?
For the Jets or
yep.
for the Patriots?
Both.
Well, for the Jets, it's funny, we didn't get the news until we were just kind of coming out of the locker room, so we didn't have an opportunity to really discuss it, although one of the players said, I think I just heard that Mayo's out. But, we've seen on our end, the Jets have seen that this Patriot team with Bill Belichick at the helm doesn't change depending on who the personnel is.
Right.
They do what they do, and I think this Jets team, having lost the last 8 games, against the Patriots, is very, very well aware of that. So in some ways, while I was actually talking to Tony Richardson real quick, while he was gearing up for Gerard Mayo, I don't think he's going to let down at all in preparation for anybody else.
I can't imagine anybody in the Jets letting down for anything on the Patriots, especially, as you've already pointed out, the fact that the Patriots have somehow managed to win 8 straight in the Meadowlands against the Jets. And I can't imagine that sitting too well, and that Rex Ryan has probably beaten that one like a dead horse this week.
Yeah, Ryan addressed that a little bit. He basically said, look, they have 8, and I don't really want to see them get 9. So he's Rex Ryan is what you see him as. He is that guy. He's very outspoken. He has nothing to hide. He says what's on his mind, which is actually a lot of fun and very funny. But he's real serious when it comes to football, and you get the feeling he really, really does truly believe in this team and believe they can beat anybody. And I think we will see what has to actually happen this weekend and how that goes.
You know, I know the Patriots fans like to, think that some of the stuff that a guy like Rex Ryan has done has been sort of amateurish, or maybe he's putting his foot in his mouth, or maybe he's just trying to stir the embers of the rivalry between the Pats and Jets. But I actually like this move that he made when finding out, thanks to ProFootballTalk.com, that earlier this week he sent out, a voicemail to Jets season ticket holders that basically asked the fans to, quote, get ready to go for 4 quarters, get after the Patriots, especially when our defense is up there. We really need you. We want it to be miserable for Brady and company and seem like there are 13 or 14 guys out there on defense. I actually thought that was a very college-type thing to do, but I thought that was pretty cool.
It is kind of cool because what it shows you is what we've been seeing from Rex Ryan since he got hired, that he is a guy who's all in. This is his team now. He's the head coach. And that energy and that personality has actually permeated this whole building very quickly. And what it's done is given people a feeling they belong to something. And he sees that, especially in New York, as I'm sure a lot of people are aware, the Jets have for a long time been kind of the second child next to the Giants. Giants have a longer history. They have more championships. And the Jets have been chasing that for a long time and sort of get a little bit of a short shrift here, I think, sometimes. And or at least I know the fans would complain about that. So I think what Ryan's trying to show is this is his team. These are the New York Jets. They're not to be taken lightly. And this is as good of a team as any team that they'll see. And he wants to rally the fans around that, too, because coming from the places he's come from where the fan base was so strong and so behind their team, he's trying to rally that up and show people that about that. And it's he's creating an era of fun, which is what he will say to you always is what football is about. It's supposed to be fun.
Have these players bought into everything he is doing? I mean, are they still kind of looking at him with a raised eyebrow with some of the things he does?
No, I think from what I can tell, I've been covering this team now for about 10 years, and I know these players really well, and they have bought in completely. And he put in such a change, and the reason they've bought in is because I think they realize very quickly that he's very genuine. Everything he says is just sincerely coming from him. It's not calculated. It's not contrived. It's not him trying to figure out what message to send. It's just what he thinks. And I think with players, when you see someone being that genuine, who believes in himself and believes in them, they give that back to him. So I think that they really are completely on board.
Well, frankly, I like the way that he's kind of stoking the embers here, because I think it's always better when there's a great continuation of Boston versus New York, no matter the sport, no matter the actual franchises involved. I think it's good overall. It kind of gets everybody's blood going a little bit. And you choose a great word in the word genuine, because I want to know from you, Lisa. Again, Lisa Zimmerman from CBSSports.com covers the New York Jets. I want to know if you think Mark Sanchez is the genuine deal at quarterback.
Well, it's an interesting question. I've been getting asked that all week after last weekend's win. And looking at how he played, I think you would say yes. But as I've been saying, I tend to be a little conservative. I like to balance it. I'm supposed to be a journalist, so you got to be a little balanced.
Right, sure.
And I think we obviously have to give it time because it was one game. He looked terrific in the one game. He really did. He made a lot of good decisions, a couple of bad ones that he'll be the first guy to tell you, oh, my God, what was I thinking? But overall, he does have a maturity level about him and just an overall talent about him. I mean, he's really got some very instinctive football talent that's going to serve him well. And if it can, if he continues to look this way as they continue to play, then I think, yeah, this team has the real deal in him.
Well, I have to admit, I was real impressed with his poise. I watched most of the game against Houston, and like a lot of other people, I thought that Houston at home would put up a much better game than they did. But the one overriding – I have two overriding feels from game one that the Jets played. Number one, Sanchez, I thought, played, let's put it this way. His performance belied his experience. And number two, I thought the Jets' defense was way better than I thought it would be.
Well, and I think that was on, in a way, that was sort of on purpose. They let it be known this past week, and I'd actually spoken to Bart Scott about this the week before the first game, and he said to me, Lise, you know, look, we've shown nothing. Because it was funny how they were so up and down during the preseason, but all teams tend to be very what they call vanilla during the offseason.
Right.
But Scott even said to me, he's like, you know, we've shown nothing. He said, we're not going to show anything. Most teams don't, because you don't want to get you on film. So I think a lot of people were taken aback because they didn't see during preseason what Ryan had been talking about people seeing from this team. So people were thinking, well, gee, where's all the big talk that you've been saying? Where is that on the field? And then I think it finally they were able to break it out this past weekend, and I think that's the defense you're going to see.
Well, defensively, like the Patriots, there has been a little bit of a change in the linebacking core. Obviously, the Patriots, because of an injury, will be without Jerod Mayo. The Jets are without Calvin Pace because of a four-game suspension. In your estimation, how did Vernon Golston do filling in?
He did okay, and even I would rather defer to what Rex Ryan's opinion was of him, which was up and down.
Okay.
Because Rex has been championing him most of the preseason, the offseason, and Ryan's review of him was up and down, that he needs to still do some things better. He needs to have a little more, I think what I will infer from what Ryan said was a little more fire in him. He wants to see him finishing, helping take a player down who may already have a guy on him or whatever. So I think he's still got a bit of a way to go. He's got the talent, I think, especially when he's rushing the passer. I think he's got to get stronger on some of the other stuff. Fortunately, they've got a lot of depth there right now, and once they get Pace back, that'll be good. But they did manage well this past weekend without Pace or Sean Ellis.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a good sign for Jets fans that they were able to perform without those two guys.
Best attribute in your estimation of this overall Jets defense?
I'm sorry, I missed that. What?
Best attribute overall of this Jets defense in your estimation?
I think what you mentioned earlier. I think their belief in what they're doing.
Okay.
That they really do believe in this system, in the schemes they're running, and they believe that what Ryan is having them do is going to work. And I think, as you and I both know, the psychological aspect of this game outweighs anything else. So the fact that they believe that this is going to work is, I think, the best attribute going for them right now. I mean, they have a lot of talent at different positions. I don't know that they have the best guys at their positions around the league necessarily, maybe Darrell Revis, maybe Chris Jenkins. But I think it's the belief and the confidence that they're bringing to the field now with Rex Ryan behind them.
Just kind of off the – we're kind of off the beaten path on this one, but last week there was a story about how the Jets might have been somewhat deceptive over the reporting of Brett Favre's injury a year ago. And because you've mentioned already now, Lisa, that you've covered this team for 10 years, do you trust Rex Ryan? Do you trust what the Jets tell you now to be fact?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because there are still people here in the front office who remain the same. I think the news just broke about that the organization has been fined $75,000 by the league.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Eric Mangini was fined $25,000. And I believe, I have to clear this up because I came on to with you guys, I think Mike Tannenbaum might have been fined separately.
I think that's the case. I'm just seeing it right now.
And they're both fined $25,000 apiece. And and I'm not trying to make accusations, but the fact is Mike Tannenbaum is still here. Eric Mangini is no longer.
Right.
So I think with Rex Ryan on board, yes, I believe what comes out of Rex Ryan's mouth. We know he's going to be a little more reserved with what he tells us in the season because there is an injury game planning element to that. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
But we are a little more, I would say we are a little more comfortable with that what we're getting from him is the truth, because what he tends to do is when he can't tell us the truth, he says he can't.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And what else do you want?
Yeah, right. No, that's actually a very good point. Very good point. All right, back a little bit more on the beaten path. The other roster move of note this week that I think fans here would be most interested in is the fact that Sean Ellis was officially reinstated to the roster Monday, correct?
Correct.
Okay. How do you expect his impact to affect the team defensively?
Well, we'll see. What he adds is another guy with experience who can be very effective when he's on. And having him back, like I said, as a veteran who's faced the Patriots numerous times now is always good.
Right.
They did quite fine without him last week, so I think that him coming back will only be a positive because he can bring a positive, and there's a rotation now, and he's one more guy to put into that rotation. So I think it's a positive to get him back. I think he is also feeling the lesson that he has learned, so we might see maybe him stepping up a little bit more even. But this is a guy who's been playing a long time. I mean, he's been playing almost 10 years, so he's certainly heading on to the down part of his career.
I know that he was inactive this last week, but Kevin O'Connell, of course, was a Patriots backup here and a draft choice a year ago, was picked up by Coach Ryan and the Jets. Do you see him, A, being active, B, at the very least, providing insight as to what the Patriots might do offensively?
Oh, yeah, and just to, this is a perfect example. Rex Ryan offered today that he has, in fact, picked O'Connell's brain. And rather thoroughly, he didn't go into detail about what he told him, but he said, oh, yeah, of course. He said, of course, what are we going to do, bring the guy in and not sit him down and talk to him? I mean, this is how candid Coach Ryan is. He said, what do you think? I'm not going to do that. So he's very open. We brought him in. We sat him down. We picked his brain. We've had him go over some film where he pointed out what maybe the Jets might have thought was this. And he said, no, it's this, and they'll do this and that. So, oh, yeah, they've been very open. They have utilized him as best they can. I don't know that he'll be active. That I would say, I would not expect to see him active.
Right, okay. The other thing that I was really impressed with from the Jets' win over Houston was the fact that Mark Sanchez was not sacked, which largely tells me that the offensive line was pretty much in tune with each other. I guess DeBrickashaw Ferguson had a big penalty against Houston, but they really seemed to be operating as a unit. The running game seemed relatively solid. I mean, what would you grade the offense's performance for an opener?
That's a hard question, but I think I'd have to give them an A-minus, because I don't think they did things perfectly, but I think they did things, it looked like everything, as the guys would say, everything was clicking.
Yeah.
The offensive line, this is their second year together as a unit, so that's huge for them, and it's interesting to watch DeBrickashaw Ferguson's progression from his rookie year till now. I mean, he's just made leaps and bounds. And, Ryan constantly calls him a premier left tackle in the league. And he's done a great job. As you pointed out, Sanchez was kept clean for the game, and the running game was able to take off. He did quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And I would expect if the guys stay healthy, then that they could be a really, really effective offensive line, which for Mark Sanchez, I think, is taking a nice load off his back. Or of his shoulders, because he can rely on the fact that he's going to have time to do what he needs to do.
Thomas Jones had 107, couple of touchdowns. Leon Washington, 60 yards, 15 carries. Pretty good average there. I'd say that's a pretty good 1-2 punch at running back.
It's a very good 1-2 punch, and what Jets fans were crying for last year was Leon Washington was all but taken out of the game last year. He disappeared. And then Rex Ryan made that known right away when he came in that they're going to be seeing a lot of Leon Washington, because Jones and Washington have two completely different running styles. They're two completely different body types, so they offer them different options. And the Jets, of course, drafted Sean Green out of Iowa, who's almost a combination of the two of them. The knock on him was he was not a pass catcher, but when he was at Iowa, he was never asked to catch the ball. So they've been working on that with him. He, unfortunately, has been having one injury after the next. He had a bad ankle injury in camp. Now he's got a rib thing happening. He's got some torn cartilage. So I don't know when we'll see him making an impact in the game, but I know they like him a lot when he's healthy. They're looking at him to make really a sort of a three-headed attack there at running back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to admit, Lisa, looking at this matchup, as we're starting to kind of piece things together here, I don't think it bodes very well for New England. And I'm not just saying that because I think that maybe their time is up, having won 8 straight in New York. But quite frankly, I just don't think the matchups favor New England here unless somehow Patriots can find a way to put pressure on Sanchez and make him, shall we say, act a little bit more like a rookie. From the New York perspective, how do you look at it?
Well, I'll tell you what. I've seen a lot here, and while looking at it, obviously being in the locker room here, watching, being up close, I see a lot of progress here with this team. Mm-hmm. I see a better team this year than last year with the New York Jets. But what I would look at is say, this is the New England Patriots. This is Bill Belichick. And I spoke to numerous players today in the locker room about the consistency that the Patriots have brought for the last number of years. And every single person points to the fact that what Patriots bring is this amazing coaching, which is detail-oriented and focusing on the fundamentals and doing what they do best. And I don't see that changing from the Patriots anytime soon. So I don't know. I think I wouldn't be surprised if the Jets won, but nor would I be surprised if the Patriots won either, just given the kind of game they play.
Do you think this rivalry will stick around for a little while longer then?
Oh, I think so.
That's always fun. Oh, you got to admit, it makes it a little bit more interesting to cover, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, completely. Oh, sure. And you know, the whole division, all the division rivals are fun, but this one has just taken on such a life of its own. But yeah, it's been fun. I mean, we had a packed house here today. So
awesome.
As far as the press goes. So yeah, I think everyone's gearing up for a fun weekend.
Awesome. Lisa, I appreciate your spending time with us today. Thanks so much. We'll look forward to reading your stuff this week.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks, John.
That's Lisa Zimmerman, who covers the Jets for CBSSports.com. You check out her stuff online and get some of the latest on the Jets. I'm sitting here talking to Lisa as we're going along here, and I'm convincing myself the Patriots are going to get beat. I mean, I'm thinking, wow, looking at the stat sheet, the Texans didn't even touch Mark Sanchez. And just about every prediction that I saw last week had the Texans holding fort and winning at home, because a lot of people think that the Texans will actually reach the playoffs for the first time ever. And, you know, and the Jets were going to be sort of the victim here. And the Jets controlled the line of scrimmage. I watched that game. As I told the guys in PFW a couple of hours ago, I was thrilled this weekend because I normally have to work Sundays. So without the Patriots playing on Sunday and the fact that it was a free preview weekend for the the NFL game day, whatever they call it, package on DirecTV, I got to watch all the games because I have DirecTV at home. And so I watched the Jets and Texans. That was my primary one because I knew that's the next Patriot opponent. Trying to do a little advanced scouting for you here, kids. And I was totally impressed with the way the Jets controlled everything. Tempo, line of scrimmage, battle in the trenches. They kept, the Texans away from Sanchez. I mean, Sanchez, he wasn't that well protected at USC. Mario Williams was never a factor for the Texans at all. Never. You know, the offensive line gets tremendous credit. You know, I mean, I realize that, you know, Sanchez is the one making the headlines after the first week, and perhaps rightfully so, but that offensive line, not only, you know, protecting Sanchez, but opening holes for both Jones and Washington, I was really impressed with the way they controlled Houston. And I do think that the Patriots are going to be in for a difficult time this Sunday, especially since, you know, as the first thing that Lisa pointed out in our conversation here was that today in the Jets locker room, the focus was on the fact that the Patriots have won 8 straight at the Meadowlands against the Jets. 8 straight. Not talking about 8 games overall. 8 straight road wins for the Patriots against the Jets overall. That's extraordinary. I use the term extraordinary for the 12 wins in a row over the Bills overall. But 8 in a row on the road? That's just, you don't hear these things in this day and age of everybody, you know, trying to be equal in the NFL. You just don't hear that. And that's a number I'm sure that will sit long and hard in the backs of the minds of all the Jets and their coaches this week. So don't underestimate emotion being a factor on the Jets sideline on Sunday. Should get you juiced and pumped for the game, without a doubt, I would think, and probably will be so for the Patriots this week as well. I hope that they're ready. I certainly hope that they're ready for everything that's coming to them, because it will be coming to them. All right, let's wrap up with a few emails here. Irene in Tampa, where you been, Irene? Where have you been? I came all the way to Tampa last year to see you, and I didn't see you. I mean, come on. It's a big city, I know. I'll be in Tampa twice in October. Got USF games to do. So anyway, she says, John, what a pleasure to hear your voice again. Thank you, Irene. It was a way too long of an off season for me. I have nothing to offer today except to tell you that it was a bit disappointing not to be able to see all the 50 best Patriots at halftime. I do like the history of the AFL. I am out of the market, so I had to rely on the national broadcast, but I am happy to say that I now have the NFL package in HD so I can follow my beloved team this year without missing a game. Good for you. Like I said, I got to watch it this last Sunday for the first time and was thrilled with it. Hopefully that will allow me to add some insight to some of the conversations you will have in future shows. Thanks again, John. I'm really looking forward to this season. Irene, I always like it when you write, okay? Doesn't matter that you can offer insight or not. You can just call and you can just write and say, hey, how's it going today? You're allowed because, Irene, you've been here basically from day one, if I'm not mistaken here. You've been here with us for a long time. This is the ninth season now we've had Playbook here on Patriots.com, Patriots.com Radio. It's 10 years for Patriots.com Radio, ninth that we've had the Playbook. Let's get to Dale. You were going to say something, Jason?
No.
Okay. You look like you wanted to say something. Dale, let's see. What does he say here? Not sure what I was hearing when I tuned in, but I thought Lawrence Maroney was having a great game. He had the best kickoff return, after which they didn't kick it to him anymore. 36 yards and 5 carries in the first quarter. Yes. Second quarter, it was Fred Taylor. By the second half, the Pats were screwing around on offense, trying to get everyone on the same page. Lomo, did he come up with that, or did somebody else coin that phrase, Lomo?
I don't know, but I think it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it is kind of ridiculous. I don't like that one. Nah, I don't
Lame-o.
Like that. Now, you said that. I didn't.
No, not about Lawrence, about the nickname.
Actually, I like that one better. That's terrible, but
you
I like
said
it better.
That.
Come on. Can't have some fun. It's just not worth doing. He says, Lomo's rushing attempt, one rushing attempt in the second half involved meeting five white shirts in the backfield as soon as he had the ball. I didn't see any juking around from him behind the line except when I would have been doing it too. Standing there with the ball and many large guys waiting for me. Bad game for the O-line, including a failed short yardage run in the first quarter. I agree with that. It just didn't seem to be that everybody was on the same page where that was concerned because you never see the Patriots fail in short yardage situations. In fact, most of the time you see Tom Brady stretch out that 6'4" frame in short yardage situations, and I'm wondering maybe, you know, if the thing on his knee had anything to do with that. I don't know. I'm very happy to tell you that Christina Acker has joined us here in studio. Hello, Christina.
Hi there.
She's got, of course, Shop Talk coming up next. A couple of questions already on here for you,
nice.
Email-wise,
good.
For Shop
Keep
Talk.
Keep them
so,
coming.
I know. So for those that are uninitiated, why don't you give us, again, a brief overview of what Shop Talk's all about.
Shop Talk. I'm joined by some of the guys from the Patriots Pro Shop here at Gillette Stadium, also the online store, to just give you guys an update on the latest materials and items in the store that you can find, all the vintage throwback stuff going on, all the updates and how you can get stuff shipped to you. Whatever questions you have, bring them on because we're here for an hour from 4 to 5 to answer the questions.
How cool, by the way, was actually seeing the Reds out there? I mean, I just, first of all, it was a different look for a lot of fans simply because they haven't worn it at home in 15 years.
Right, right. I mean, I loved the red. I thought it was sharp. I thought it looked great. I think a lot of people were, it took them a second to really get in sync up in the press box. They're like, who are we watching here? What team is this?
But
it took a second, but I thought it looked good. The whole theme of the throwback was pretty cool.
Well, I think the fact that they're going to get to do it 3 more times and we get them, what, once more at home with the throwbacks, right? 2 on the road, 2 at home. I think that's very cool. Yeah. Certainly it's going to help, you know, spur sales, which I think we all realize in this economic climate everybody needs, whether you're the Patriots or not.
Right.
Gives you something new to buy, something new to look forward to. It's kind of a neat thing. And I mentioned this earlier in the program. One of the things that I can really appreciate about this whole AFL legacy thing is that the AFL, while I'm as old school as they come, in spite of my gray hair here, I'm as old school as they come. And I appreciate, and as I've grown older, have appreciated the AFL more for what it has meant to the overall growth in the last, 40 years, really, of the National Football League into being, I think, the preeminent fan involvement sport, certainly, you know, in this country. Because, let's face it, you know, it was once upon a time where baseball was the pastime here. I think we can all relatively say here with good solid assurance that football has sort of bypassed that. And it's just a continuation, though, of what the AFL did to pro football. It gave everybody a little injection back in the 1960s. I'm old enough to remember that and old enough to remember, oh, the AFL, they'll never measure up to the National Football. It's just, you know, too new school. It was too Joe Namath-y, you know, too Fred Biletnikoff and Daryl LaMonica-y. And, you know, it just wasn't football. But then when the NFL told the AFL, we're bringing you in 1970, And then we had the NFC and the AFC.
Right.
Little history lesson here.
Right.
For
yeah, I'm
that
learning. I'm taking
it, right?
notes. You're spitting out names. I'm.
But here's the thing, the AFL for the last several years, and you don't have to be a longtime football fan to know this. Mm-hmm. The AFL for the last several years has been the dominant conference. The AFC, I should say, has been the dominant conference. When you go head to head, when you look at Super Bowl results.
Right.
I mean, you know, Giants game 2 years ago notwithstanding. You know, the fact is that, you know, the AFC has been the preeminent conference in terms of the overall team strength. And if it weren't for the AFL, and if it weren't for the history behind the throwbacks that we're all going to be watching, the NFL, arguably, and maybe even inarguably, would not be what it is today.
Right. It's all in the roots. And, I mean, I think it even brings the players down to a sense. Yeah, like, where it all came from, where it started, and what it's grown to be today. Like you said, it may not be at this extent if they didn't have that back then. So I think it's cool. It's, you know, celebrating history.
Absolutely. So that's what we're going to do throughout the course of the year. And I guess that's part of what you'll be doing on Shop Talk.
Yes, Shop Talk. Okay. That.
Good.
Fill
Very
you
good.
In. And
Thanks.
Lawrence Maroney also has another nickname, by the way. Just throw it out there. Kool-Aid, so.
Kool-Aid?
Yeah. Sip on that one for a little bit.
Ah.
I see what you did there.
Thanks for sharing. All right, cool. All right, so she's coming up here in just a moment, a couple of moments on the show. Let me do this just because everybody has been so nice to write these emails. Let me squeeze in two quick notes here. Manny in Virginia writes, since the Kraft Belichick era, one constant from coaches and players has been hard work and situational football. We witnessed the best in the business at executing this in the fourth quarter of the Bills game. Coach Belichick said in his press conference, it's not the way they drew it up, but if you've been a fan of this team since Bill's arrival, it is coached and executed day in and day out. Pat's players from top to bottom always speak of hard work and situational football. It starts at the top. It was awesome to watch, a thrill for us fans that follow this team on a daily basis, 365 days a year. Thank you, Manuel. And then Howard, our friend in Orange, Connecticut, and one of our longtime contributors here, says, John, good to have you back and the program back for another fun-filled year of Patriots football. Game one went nothing like I thought it was going to go, but a win is a win. I'll take it and move on looking for improvement week to week. He says he was pleasantly surprised by the secondary, an area that I personally thought was the biggest question mark on the D. I was disappointed in the pressure or lack thereof until the end of the game that the front seven got on Trent Edwards. This was a Bills team that started three new starters on the offensive line. They had better get their stuff together for the Jets because they have a very good offensive line and a world-class running back in Washington to boot. No question. Absolutely no question. By the way, he also spoke to our email question today asking, what would you do if you had to replace Gerard Mayo in the lineup? He says, it will be interesting to see if they go with Guyton or Alexander at middle linebacker. Alexander did start the Super Bowl at inside linebacker, so it's not like he's inexperienced, but he obviously is no Mayo. Guyton has the starting experience at inside linebacker, and from what I have seen, appears to be a better overall fit at the middle linebacker position. Let's see, and he also mentions about the game. I know you'll get into this later in the week, but the key to the game on Sunday is to withstand the inevitable initial onslaught by a team that has said they are treating this like the Super Bowl, combined with the home opener crowd excitement that I'm certain will be like being at the Super Bowl, since we all know Jets fans tend to get carried away anyway. Survive that, and I think if the Pats can play their A game, they can possibly win the game. Anything less, they'll be 1-1 after Sunday. Thank you, Jason. All right, so that ought to whet your appetite. Tomorrow, inside the playbook, we will have Russell Baxter once again from ESPN, the NFL research coordinator, joining us with his thoughts not only on week one's play overall around the league, but certainly looking ahead to week two and featuring the Pats and the Jets. We'll also have our conference calls with members of the Jets, and we'll have a locker room conversation with members of the Patriots, all coming up on Thursday's edition of the Playbook.
And possibly one more guest.
Oh, so now that's the ultimate tease is what you're telling me?
Ultimate tease.
You're not even going to tell me who it is?
I don't have confirmation yet, but we're working on one more for you.
Excellent. Well, then you're just going to have to tune in tomorrow and find out. Okay? Shop Talk's coming up. Thank you for being inside the Playbook. Same Pats time, same Pats channel. Mañana.